This episode is sponsored in part by Swim. Okay, here's a depressing stat. 70% of shoppers who want your products never actually buy them. They browse, they consider, then they forget. That's revenue walking out the door. Swim Wishlist Plus turns browsers into buyers. Customers save products they want, get notified when prices drop or items restock. You can also engage them in personalized fashion through your marketing or sales outreach. It's like having a personal shopper reminding them to come back and buy from you instead of your competitors. And 45,000 stores already use it, and it only takes 5 minutes to install. You can try it free today for 14 days. Go to getswim.com/Kurt. That's swimwithay.com/Kurt. Turn those maybe laters into sales today. Getswim.com. Today on the unofficial Shopify podcast, we've got a CRO episode. We're going to talk tips and tricks for conversion rate optimization. And joining me to do it with his expert advice is Sean Brandt from Audit. He's a previous guest, a fan favorite, had lots of spicy takes on what it takes to make a store design work. And certainly, you know, in my own work with clients, Shopify merchants doing theme design and setup, I have my fair share of pet peeves as well that we'll go through. And so I think there's just a lot of common mistakes that you figure out through experience that we could give you some shortcuts and some quick wins and some low-hanging fruit by talking through together the common mistakes. I'm Kurt Elster. This is the unofficial Shopify podcast. Sean, welcome.
Thanks, Kurt. I'm excited to dive back in. The first one, it was a lot of fun. And we went through a lot of stuff, but there's just so much more to uncover.
You're from Audit, O-D-D-I-T, and you've done 10,000 UX audits. Just give me a little bit about the background, your background. So, who are you? Why should we care?
Yeah, my background is almost exclusively in UX design. Oddly enough, before Audit, Audit is an e-com focused company. And before Audit, I had never done any e-commerce design. Really worked on a lot of other types of user experiences, a lot of complex applications, or really boring applications. But that's kind of where we got all of our learnings from, was how do you take really boring UX journeys and make them interesting, make them unique, make them convert higher, make them so that people complete them. In e-commerce, it's very much like 1, 2, 3 pages or 1, 2, 3 clicks, and you're kind of out the door in a lot of cases. With more complex journeys, you really have to get creative with how to get someone through that. And so taking all of those learnings from doing, a decade of more large scale user experiences, it just became natural to filter that into e-com because, across 10,000 e-com audits, 9,990 of them have a lot of the same issues. So because the journeys are all built off of very similar templates. So it's been a really natural transition into e-commerce, and it's been really fun.
What any design trends you're noticing this year? Has anything shifted? The only trend I've noticed is Apple and their UIs can sometimes drive a lot of change in trends, and now they're doing this glass look again. So I suspect that we're going to see some of that. But beyond that, kind of superficial stuff, any trends you're noticing?
I think more and more tools are popping up that are giving people the opportunity to use AI for their imagery. So we're seeing a huge shift away from getting photo shoots done of products or lifestyle images and trying to use AI to make the product look more premium in a lot of cases. I think a lot of sites over the last 5-10 years, the struggle to make the product look premium isn't actually a fault of the product. It's how they're capturing it, how they're displaying it. Really nice art-directed photography of your products hasn't been easy. It isn't easy. AI's made that a little bit simpler, but it's also thrown a lot of curveballs into that whole process because it's not, it's not at the point yet where it's just type in a quick prompt and it's boom, you've got the perfect image. And so there's a lot of sites that we're seeing come through where it's really clear they used AI and they didn't know what they were doing. And then there's some sites coming through where they tell me it's AI and I'm kind of like, what? Like I can't tell the difference. So I think the biggest trend we're going to see over the next 6 to 12 months is you're going to see more and more of that. It's going to get cleaner and cleaner and you're just not going to be able to tell the difference anymore, which is good and bad, right? In a good sense, the brand's going to build more trust because a lot of their imagery is going to be nicer. I think on the bad side, it's going to allow a lot of crappy products to look more premium than they are. And yeah. I think that can be a little bit misleading.
For sure. And you know, with the image generation tools, you're right, they're getting progressively better, but they're not perfect. And you know, I think the biggest issue I find with them is consistency. Even if I can get it to do exactly what I want once, okay, now make it do it again. And like, and you just can't, the way those systems work, it is often very difficult to reproduce the same image consistently. Think about like a set of product photos. It's rarely just one, you know, you need five. Suddenly they all look a little different.
Yeah, and that's kind of part of what surprised me is getting that one exact image of what you want is actually quite, not easy, but it's the easiest part of it. That's the hardest part in design is getting, establishing that first aesthetic.
Yeah.
And then the easy part is just replicating. That's by far the easiest part. Where AI, it's flipped, which I mean, that's not my space, but that doesn't make sense to me. To me, that's the easiest part of the design task. So replicating and saying, okay, I want that same image, but a different angle. And then it spits it back out with a different background. And you're like, this is, you know, I could be paying someone for 3 minutes and they do it better. So there's certain aspects of it. Like I said, they're just not there yet. And that consistency isn't there yet. So it's tough.
I think the opportunity is big, but the risk there is as soon as someone notice it, it's AI slop, especially like you see this in Instagram comments, social media comments, they'll call it out immediately and it just murders trust in the brand. Yeah. Like everyone's all for AI until they know it's there, right? Then suddenly they want nothing to do with it. No one wants to consume the AI content, at least not knowingly. And so if you could tell, you didn't do a good enough job. So great for placeholders. If you get a good result out of it, great. But if it's obvious, you know, that's an issue. And usually it's like the little text is always the dead giveaway, or, you know, there'll be weird inconsistencies in it. So out of thousands of those UX audits, remind us, what's that number one mistake that everybody makes?
It's mostly merchant driven, right? Like the Shopify keeps updating templates and adding new templates and following the right trends. So 90% of the framework that's there in every store is kind of changing and being consistent over time because they're all using basically templates from the same store. I think that the main thing that people keep screwing up is that content side, copywriting, imagery, and at the end of the day, just not being clear enough. Everyone wants to be really, really creative and inject that personality that they see being the cornerstone of their brand or their products. And because, you know, 99% of Shopify stores are making their money from ad traffic, you just don't have that much time. We don't have time to sit and convince them through creative copy. You need to convince them what's great about it, what it is, what's great about it, and what other people think about it. I think that's the biggest thing that's every single, whether it's a free trial, whether it's a $10,000 audit report, the most consistent thing we're constantly talking about is copywriting, whether that's button labels, headlines, FAQs, everything. It's just not clear enough. And so that's held true since day one. That really hasn't changed.
And you know, in our own CRO work, in split testing, often the most impactful stuff is just content changes, copy changes, you know, even just micro copy like button labels is quite incredible. And, you know, it's deceptively easy, deceptively simple. And so I think it gets overlooked, especially because people want to, you know, mess with the cool stuff, right? As opposed to just focusing on clarity, being clear. Okay, let's jump into our top conversion mistakes. On this show, consistently, I have said the number one issue is main menus, but more specific, the dead giveaways you land on the site. First thing's a home link. Second thing just says shop. It's a drop down and it's got everything in it. And then, you know, it'll be all our other top parent main menu links will be like supporting pages, FAQ about contact. And then the important thing, the shopping, products, and collections all gets buried in nested menus. I think that's such a mistake. Because if I go on a major retailer site, Target, Walmart, Best Buy, whatever, that main menu will, every single thing on it will go to a product or a category page, a collection page.
Yeah.
And that would baffles me that like people can shop on, you know, these big box stores, all these stores, and never put together that like, oh, their menu really is not as complicated as it seems. And mine is way more complicated than it needs to be.
Yeah. It's one of those things where, especially in e-com, again, 99% of the stores, there's three primary touch points: homepage, a collection page, and a product page. Now there's things outside of that. In some cases, unique product pages or unique bundle builders and stuff like that. But primarily that's the three areas. And so if they land on the homepage, they should be getting into add to cart within three clicks. If they land on a collection page, or sorry, four clicks, I guess. If they land on a collection page, they should be getting add to cart within three clicks. Product page, arguably one click because they're already there. But the biggest mistake in menus is, like you said, they're burying things, clicks upon clicks upon clicks. We were dealing with one.
It's got a name. Oh, click debt.
Yeah. Yeah. It's if you just imagine that you're driving a user to your, let's say, homepage or landing page, and you only get three clicks, you know, you can't nest things like that, right? Like a lot of brands we deal with, they have 10 products and they're like nesting them in deep collections. Or we had a customer yesterday, they couldn't figure out why they were having drop off on their collection page. And they only have one product. So I'm like, okay, well, why are you driving customers to a collection page with one product? That should be a product page. There's no collection. Like you're ignoring the fact that you have one product. Every link in that nav should be going to one page, the product page, because your collection page is just a card. And all of that comes back to navigation. We always talk to our customers about, if you just imagined your navigation being expanded into entry points as your homepage flow, would you nest everything, right? Would you hide product cards behind a click? No, of course not. You're wasting clicks. You're wasting their time, and that's just driving conversion down. Every time you waste their time, you're driving conversion down.
And I think, you know, what happens is people say, I want to get people to the right thing fast enough. Good. So I think the intent is right. It's like, I want to show them what's available on the site. I've made these pages content. I want to surface it to them. So I'm just going to jam everything in the main menu where they could find it. That's mistake one. You know, only show them what's relevant and put it where they expect. And so that main menu, just merch, products, collections. And then within it, then they get over specific. Whereas, you know, it's fine to take me to a broader collection page and then they filter it down there. Or you take me to a product page and then I pick my options in the form, as opposed to trying to get them to make all of the decisions in a nested menu.
Yeah.
So all right. I think we got menus figured out. Give me one of yours. Give me one more.
Checkout is probably one of the biggest ones that we get asked about. Brands are just constantly struggling to optimize checkout for two reasons. One, they're not on Shopify Plus, so they can't actually edit checkout. So that's a really tough one. And so they're looking for like, what are those little hacks you can do within those confines of an uneditable checkout? And then they've installed all of these different applications in checkout, whether it's shipping insurance or all that stuff. And it just convolutes the whole process.
Can I interrupt you to ask what you think of shipping insurance?
I think that unless your product is like crazy expensive, right? Like we have multiple clients that are large diamond producers and you know, they're shipping $10,000 diamond rings and stuff like that. Totally makes sense to me. If I'm buying a 3-pack of t-shirts, why am I buying shipping insurance? Like those are the types of orders that within my household are being made every 2 days, whether it's from Amazon or an e-com brand. Again, most of the internet these days takes their trends from Amazon, and they probably have shipping insurance, but I've never been pushed it. Like, do you think that's
never an add-on?
That's not an accident. It's because it doesn't provide them any additional conversion, so they don't do it. Again, that's a much bigger beast.
Is the FTC's no junk fees rule has taken effect. And a shipping fee, I believe, is a junk fee. So it has to be, you know, in the past, you'd see it like default checked. Can't do that anymore, right? I believe Shopify said no. And the FTC says, hey, that's a junk fee. And yeah, I don't want to mess with federal governmental organizations. And so if you still offer these shipping insurances, they got to be unchecked by default. Just calling that out now.
Yeah. And I mean, that's what it should be. I think a lot of brands try and sneak those things in. And
that's a dark pattern. I don't like it.
Yeah. Short term, you might get a few extra bucks per order and you're going to go to your, you know, you're the UX guy on the team. You're going to go to your boss and be like, oh, AOV went up 3% this month. But the long-term negative impact on your brand of crap like that is just so big. It's not worth it ever. But I think one of the things we've been doing, which I actually learned from a customer who was doing it, is if you're not on Shopify Plus and you still want to inject something into the checkout where you really can't currently, the only field that you can truly edit completely is your logo.
Yep.
So we had a customer who just, they made their logo full width of the entire, or their logo, the image that goes where their logo would be.
Yeah, you could do logo and then you could do a background behind it. The background, you don't know how it's going to crop. The logo is always going to be visible. I like where this is going.
Yeah, you got to be really careful with how you do that background of it. But we've had a lot of customers who take all the recommendations we normally make on a customized checkout, and they just inject them into that banner image and use that space to kind of game the system and show it all up there, which I can't really disagree with. Like, you're using it to as extra trust builders or things you want to inject. Maybe it's a review up there. And at the end of the day, if I'm 6 clicks into the process on your website, I probably know where I am. I probably know that it's the audit site or the, you know, whatever brand I'm buying from. So that logo can be secondary to other content. And I think it's important to, especially in the Shopify case with smaller stores that can't afford $3,000 a month for their Shopify fees. I think it's a great little hack.
Time for a quick break from our friends at Zipify who help make this show possible. Because if tariffs are eating your margins, guess what? You are not alone. Smart merchants aren't raising prices though. They're offsetting costs by boosting average order value. And the easiest way to do that, Zipify's one-click upsell. It uses AI to recommend the best upsells and cross-sells in real time based on what your customers are buying and what's worked in your store. There's no manual setups, no split testing, just automatic personalized offers that convert. OCU can increase your average order value by up to 30% from day one. And it works everywhere. Product page, cart, checkout, post-purchase, even in the shop app. Over 50,000 Shopify stores use it. Nearly $1 billion in extra revenue has been generated. So start your 30-day free trial at zipify.com/Kurt. That's zipify.com/KURT. Because in this economy, the best defense, it's a higher AOV.
Yes, I've done that one. And the other one, you can edit the labels in the checkout. And so that gives you like a little bit of wiggle room, you know, to optimize and change things. But like, you know, the defaults are already so clear and sensible. But yeah, that's, you know, a big advantage of jumping to Shopify Plus. You know, yeah, like your monthly bill balloons. But now you could customize that checkout. You can add blocks. And so,
yeah,
you know, I think, you know, easy optimizations at checkout, if you have access to those things, then become like, all right, can we do a cross sell? Can we put some social proof in there, you know, some risk reversal, and just like those, I like those two things in a checkout. But if you don't have access, you know, to the feature to do it, well, you know, there's an easy way out. Jam it in the logo as a graphic. All right. The other one that makes me a little crazy, and this is kind of Shopify specific, is they tend to collect a lot of widgets, you know, a lot of pop-ups and buttons and sticky items. And I think part of it is, you know, apps need to justify their existence, and they also need a practical way to get themselves installed in a theme. And just like a little piece of JavaScript that tacks on, you know, a button, you know, that says reviews, that says loyalty, that's, you know, a pop-up, that's much easier. as a app developer to just get into a theme consistently and have work and then, you know, not get one-star reviews and support tickets. So I get why it happened, but, you know, you'll be in a store and this is like particularly bad on mobile. Drawer cart slides out and now there's like a live chat widget, a loyalty widget, a reviews button that are all just over my checkout button. Oh, gee, why no one converts on mobile? Yeah, because they can't click the button, right? There's a bunch of crap stuck over it.
And they're there in, a lot of them have them, like if you just imagine your site as layers of within the screen, a lot of them, that pop-up is the very top layer. So when I open my mobile menu, I can't access certain buttons. Same like you just said with cart. It just, it screws with a lot of stuff. And I think at the end of the day, it's whether it's the hijacking scroll or there's a roulette wheel or a
spin to win
or whatever, I think it's almost become so common, right? Like we could open up four sites right now, all four of them, you could pick any four random D2C brands. I would bet all four of them offer either sign up for a free shipping or sign up for 10% off.
Oh, the 10% off. It just closed those.
And it kind of becomes, it's kind of like inflation and deflation. If everyone is having the exact same effect, it's not savings. If every single store I go to has 10% off by giving my email, it is not a saving. Every customer gets it and every store does it. It is not a competitive advantage. It is not a conversion tool. It you need to be creative with those things. Whether it's a pop-up or whatever, like whichever one you choose that fits your brand best, every brand's a little different. Yeah, some are more annoying, but some brands are annoying. So kind of on brand. I think the biggest thing is what that offer is, people need to put more just creative effort into it. They just lazily limp into, okay, 10% off because everyone else is doing that. Or
I agree shipping. With you, but then it's like, okay, well, what's the better option?
I think we recommend this to a ton of brands, depending on the brand, but there's a lot of tertiary freebies that you can do that aren't physical products, right? Like let's say it's a supplement brand, just AG1, because everyone knows that one. Let's say it's AG1. If you sign up, you get they can do this because they have them, a little sample pack of a new flavor, right? If you sign up, you get 3 sample packs of these flavors we have coming out. No one else has tried them yet. Bigger brands, they can do that. Smaller brands, go on Fiverr, hire an illustrator to make you 5 cool sticker designs that relate to your brand. Put those in, free sticker pack with your next order. You'd be blown away at how well that shit works, because I was talking about this on a webinar last week, but everyone loves free stuff. Yep. Discounts are great, but 10% isn't the pushing point for me. Free stuff, everyone loves. Am I going to, you know, go get 5 stickers from Yeti or whatever brand and stick them all over stuff? No, I'm 40 years old, but I have 3 kids.
Hey, I'm 40 and I am going to stick the stickers all over my stuff.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that, but my kids love stickers. So I'm like, yeah, but stickers are fun. I mean, that's just one example, right? There's tons of things you can do.
No, I think the sticker one is brilliant. Like, obviously, it needs the right brand, but the sticker one is great because a sticker that I don't use, I save them because I'm like, well, you know, I do a lot of like DIY and craft stuff. I'm like, I might use this in the future.
Yeah.
Or I'll like give it to my, you know, my kids and they might stick it somewhere. And then it becomes this recurring reminder, you know, and in like, you know, my case, I have the stickers like all over my office and my garage. And so it's like, it really is. I get reminded of these brands I love, you know, in
100%.
Just like my everyday. But
yeah,
for years we worked with and still do worked with Hoonigan, and they would pack in stickers with their orders. And sure enough, for years, if you were on the highway in any state in the US, it was only a matter of time until you drove past a Hoonigan sticker. And it's because they're just handing them out in every order, right?
Yeah. And,
yeah, there's a lot of earned impressions on eyeballs on the highway that way. You know, if you get people to put your sticker on their car, stickers are not expensive. So if it's like streetwear, fashion and apparel, you know, any of them, like I've got stickers in my that I love, that from Shitty Coolers, Montana Knife, Tacticalories. And like I see them every day and it keeps it top of mind.
Yeah. It's crazy how like 10,000 audits, we've had one store that gave away sticker packs. And to me, as someone, at least from my generation, like, man, you get excited about a sticker. Like
I do.
I love stickers. And it's such a low-hanging, simple way. If you just imagine, there's a lot of brands out there that have 1 to 2 products, and that's all they're ever going to have. The product might slightly evolve, but they really struggle to stay creatively relevant, right? Maybe they got a new website, maybe their ads changed, but because they have such a simple, really great product, it doesn't need to change. And so things like sticker packs are just a great way to like inject brand creativity into make you feel relevant again. Every time there's an order, it's a new whatever. There's quarterly changes where it's just like 4 new ones. One's a logo and 3 are just related to the brand, whether it's illustrative or something like a tagline or a funny quote that's related to your space. I think it's totally crazy. That's it. You're giving 10% off of a $100 order, so let's say $10, or a sticker pack when you order in bulk is probably going to cost you 1 to 2.
Yeah.
Like, oh, it's not even a question to have the sticker.
And then yeah. I think the clever way to do it is you make the sticker pack or sticker an item they could buy in the site. Let them see it, give it real value, and then stick it in the cart as, you know, either it's a coupon code for this welcome offer or just run it as free gift with purchase. It's like, hey, what's your AOV? All right, add 25, 50% on that. All right, when you hit this threshold, adds the free gift with purchase to cart. Now, free gift with purchase is like my favorite promo ever for a number of reasons. And we're building an app that does it now, that does free gift with purchase. Because I'm like, man, I wish everybody would do this. And the stickers are brilliant. It's like such a great way to do it.
And I think there's, for a lot of brands, there's just, they look at it like, I have a complex product. What could I give that's free? And they stop thinking outside the box. As soon as it goes away from their primary product, they just stop. And like, you know, there's so many cup companies and shit like that where if they just gave away a free interesting straw, right, that they could order by the 10,000s. Like, I remember when Magic Spoon did that crazy, if you ordered so much cereal, you've got this like beautiful tie-dye molded bowl. And I was like, man, I need to buy 40 boxes of cereal. So it's just like when we were kids, right? The toy in the cereal box.
Oh my gosh, that is what it is.
Like it's so much of those purchases are driven by the extras, not the actual primary item. And somehow, as far as I know, the only brand that still does it is McDonald's. It's mind-blowing to me that people don't give away toys with everything, because I don't go to McDonald's for the food. It's horrible for my kids. I don't even eat it. But they force me to when they see the stupid ad that there's a Minecraft toy, right?
Oh, yeah.
So now I'm buying $40 worth of food.
Never go to McDonald's, the Minecraft toys. Suddenly, all 3 of my kids were buying Happy Meals.
Or hockey cards or whatever. They're so good at that, exactly what I was saying. They ignore their product for a second and they think creatively, how else can I get people in the door? Well, it's, getting my kids to yell at me about a stupid Minecraft toy, or in this case, a stupid sticker or whatever it is. Restaurants do it great too. Here's a coloring book for your kids.
Yep.
Oh, great. I had a better restaurant experience because my kids were not talking and bothering me. They were coloring. I'm probably going to come back with my kids. The food might have been shit. Service might have been shit. But my kids weren't talking, so I'm coming back. It saves you from a lot of potential negative feedback by having this one little delightful item that's cheap.
And even if they return the item or exchange it, they always keep the free gift, right?
Yeah, of course. So of course, like,
yeah, that's fine. Yeah, keep it. Great. We've got that sticker, magnet, pin, whatever it is, that just became an ongoing reminder and advertisement in your house for us. And I'm fine with that. So let me ask you, what are your feelings on the Fold?
Oh, man. I think... I think it gets harped on way too much. I think there's very, very few products out there that customers are going to be willing to buy based on an image, a title, maybe price, and then an add to cart button. So I'm guessing what you're referring to is add to cart above the Fold. So
that's just an easy go-to win, especially on, a product page on desktop. Hey, if we could reasonably get the add to cart button, or at least the product form, to start above the Fold, I like it just as a visual reminder of this is why you're here. This is the page. Like, yes, you could purchase this. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's great to have it above the fold if they have enough context to make the purchase, right? If you're driving them from an ad and that ad tells them every single thing they need to know to make that purchase, great. Give them only an add to cart button. You'll probably convert them. If it told them the price, gave them the images, gave them everything, great. Add to cart. But if they land there and they don't know what it's made out of, they're just sitting there looking at a whatever, $100, $300, whatever it is, and they're trying to justify the price in their heads and all they see is an image and the product title, you're not going to add to cart. Not at a high enough percentage where your conversion is great. So it's really finding that balance. And a lot of that comes down to brand, right? If it's a really big brand and a really well-known brand, that add to cart can be the only thing and they'll probably still get it. They'll probably still get it.
Shocks me. And if you go on like Apple's website for, you know, AirPods, like 200 something bucks, there, that product page, there's nothing to it. It's just like, this is a photo AirPods on white, click add to cart, stupid. Cause it's like, well, you already know you're buying it. Whereas, you know, a MacBook is like a full, you know, that's $3,000, this big product configurator. But like, certainly these add-ons and accessories are relative, which kind of brings me to my next question I wanted to ask you. Product media, right? What are our feelings on our photos? Like, we know from analytics that when someone lands on a product page, there's a solid chance, you know, sometimes like 50%, the first thing they're doing, they're going to look through all the product photos. And so like, just give me thoughts on product media.
I think, and I mean, we talk about this a lot with customers. I think that so much, especially in America, so much of e-commerce trends, so much of how we use our phones when we're shopping is driven by Amazon. And Amazon is, it puts on a clinic every time a store signs up on how to do your images. And that's not just because it's part of the page, it's because they know how important it is. And so many users use those images to shop. So, you know, showing the product in use, showing the target customer, showing everything that's included. It blows me away the amount of brands that show, I don't know, a razor. And then they don't show the fact that the razor has 7 attachments, a charging cord, a USB block, right? Every single one of those, even if they're worth 20 cents, is chipping away at their price sensitivity when it's clearly communicated everything you get. Usually when it's a bundled product, they communicate it really well. But when it's a single product, especially in electronics, they really don't do a good job of communicating it. Even Apple, right? Apple's probably doing it on purpose because they slowly removed things from the package, right? You no longer get a block and pretty soon we're not going to get a cord. So they've probably done it intentionally, but it makes me irate when people don't just clearly call out what you get in the package.
Ever had a customer cancel an order because they were shopping while high or because they broke up with their significant other? Those are real reasons customers could cancel, and they're a real headache for both you and your customers. Why should they have to email support to change, cancel, or update an order? Enter Cleverific. With Cleverific, your customers can edit their orders themselves through a self-service portal. That means fewer support tickets, faster shipping, and fewer returns. Everybody wins. Peter Manning, New York, cut their order support by 99% with Cleverific. Now it's your turn. Listeners of the Unofficial Shopify podcast get 50% off the Pro plan. Just $49 a month. Go to cleverific.com/unofficial and use promo code KURT50 at checkout. It's less hassle, happier customers with Cleverific.
How do you feel about annotated product photos? Like Amazon, you see them all the time. I think they're great. E-com sellers on their own site seem resistant to it.
The hardest thing about annotated product photos, and to be clear, I love them, is that the way that Shopify's themes have evolved, most brands, when you, let's just say that I've got my product, I've got my images, I've got my copy, my team's ready to build a site. I pick my Shopify theme, I start uploading content. They're not building it on mobile. Right? They're all sitting on their big monitors and they're building this site in desktop. And when they get to the product pages, most Shopify galleries now on desktop is this beautiful flowing grid of images. And it's really hard to make that beautiful flowing grid look good when they're not just amazing lifestyle photos and amazing, beautiful studio shots. And so when you start to throw in those more Amazon style recommendation photos, it screws with that and people step away from it. And I think you just, when you're in those situations, you've got to remember that one, those secondary ones where it's maybe more communicated and less sexy, you can have them a little bit lower down, which is going to help with that. But two, it really only matters on mobile. So they're going to be swiping anyway. You're not going to see most of them. I think just like the page after add to cart, every image should be communicating something, right? It's similar to what we were talking about with your navigation, your homepage. Your homepage is an expansion, expanded state of your navigation. That gallery should just be a really, really dialed in gallery of pretty much everything that's below the add to cart. Every single thing that you put on that product page that you think is valuable, the benefits of the product, how to use it, size chart, ingredients, all of those should be product images. Every single one of them. If it's on your product page, it should be in the gallery. If it's in your gallery, it should be on your product page. For me, it's a no-brainer.
That's smart advice. That's really good. And I like the idea of, you know, if I could figure out my main menu and get it right, then my homepage layout is really a visual version of that. And then, you know, we could extend this idea out to the product detail page and then, you know, the product photos in it. Clever.
Yeah. And the thinking of things in that manner has been really helpful for our clients, because a lot of times they're like, well, yeah, but our blog is great for SEO. And like a lot of brands, it's shop and then seven other links that have nothing to do with shop. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to show you a homepage of your expanded nav. And it basically looks like an e-commerce brand. You look like a lifestyle brand or an agency that doesn't sell anything, because there's only, you know, there's one section of products. Everything else is talking about you, and you're not selling you. You're trying to sell your products. And part of that is telling a story, but not the whole page. And it's the same on the product page. I think you need to communicate clearly, and people digest information in different ways. Some people read, some people are more visual, and you got to cater to both until you get the data that tells you which one is which.
The way we've presented this, I think people may interpret it as like, well, these are the mistakes small businesses make and they can learn from the big enterprises. And you know, I want to make it clear, and I want your thoughts on this. I'm pretty sure that, you know, from 1 to 50 million, all of these brands, regardless of the size, can make all of these mistakes, and we've probably seen it all.
Yeah, it's unbelievable the amount of times that we get into a project brief and it's just like, here's our reference sites. We want to look exactly like this. And we spend the first half of the project tearing apart big site brands to help them understand what they're doing wrong, or not necessarily wrong, but a lot of times it's talking about, well, you're not them, right? Here's the things that they're doing that alleviate a lot of the conversion risk they're taking, and you'll get there, but you're not quite there yet. Big brands just get they get away with a lot more as their brand grows. But yeah, you name the brand. I mean, we can open up any brand you want right now. We'll find something wrong with it. I guarantee it. And a lot of them, surprisingly, don't do any testing, right? It's almost like that. We do it at audit. When sales are up, you get a little bit lazy. You do a little less, right? It's like, well, don't shake the boat. It's kind of, we're going along smoothly. Let's not touch anything. And then you get caught with your pants down because you get caught off guard and something isn't working and now you're not prepared. And so I think a lot of brands get into that state where it's like, whatever, the product went viral or whatever, something happened to increase traffic and increase sales and increase conversion. And they get into that comfy zone where they don't screw with anything. They don't continue evolving. And that's a tricky place to be in, especially when you've got every small brand looking at them for tips because they're not doing shit. They've just got a great product. So every brand makes mistakes for sure.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And so I think the wisdom there is when you're looking at a competitor or an inspirational brand, you can't assume that like there is some great reasoning and testing and logic behind every decision they make. Every brand of every size sometimes, they're just like, this is blue because it's blue. End of story. You know?
Yeah. And I think there's nothing, like, you should be looking for inspiration. Don't get me wrong. I think some of the best brands out there are inspired by brands that came before them. So I don't think that's necessarily something you shouldn't be doing. It's just more of a asterisk. You know, don't just assume that it's all working because they're successful, because it's usually not the case.
Let me ask you some faster questions, some lightning questions. any design trends that you're like, man, I wish this would die?
Parallax. I saw anything parallax. I saw a site yesterday that scrolled outward. I don't even know how to explain it. Like, so it like started, and then as I scrolled, it was zooming me in and taking me down like a path.
Which I'm sure was difficult and really cool and absolutely not particularly usable.
Yeah, like I think of that on a mobile device and I'm just like, man, I can't imagine how, like 0.2 conversion. I can't even imagine what they're converting at. I think as themes continue to evolve, thankfully Shopify is doing a great job of just keeping things as simple as possible. I'm sure that's mostly so that brands sign up and stay signed up instead of getting frustrated. But they're doing a pretty good job of just keeping things simple and giving people really great blank canvases. But yeah, I think we're slowly starting to get to that point where it's almost back to like the Flash days, where people are getting a little bit too creative with movements and things like that. And it's just, one, it's heavy, and two, it just crushes your conversion. I think most brands should be just sticking within the, you know, the buffers of what Shopify provides you and don't really move outside that.
I mean, if I have to pick between animations and no animations, and I don't get to see the animations, know how it's implemented, I'm always going to default to no animations. It's like you're really not, especially after the first time you see it, you're just not adding anything to the site.
There's a few rare cases where I've seen it really tastefully done. Like, let's say you're on a subscription product page and it's the default select when you load the page, the one-time purchase versus subscription. And when you hit subscription, you know, a little sticker pops in that just says you're saving 30% versus it being there already.
Yeah.
Those little delights where it not only makes you look, but it almost forces you to look because there's an actual like visual action. Those can be really effective. But yeah, I agree. If I'm scrolling through the product page and every single photo has, you know, illustrations flashing, and you're just distracting them from what they're actually going to buy. Very rarely does it actually feel like a cohesive brand experience that pushes me further down the path.
You ever see a store that's too optimized? I mean, sometimes I'll load them and be like, oh, someone is big into CRO.
Yeah. No, it all the time. I think that for me, there's two types of brands in e-commerce. There's the brands that are very, very self-aware that their existence is 12 to 24 months. They found a product they can resell from Amazon or really cheaply made overseas. And they know they've got a strike before that store goes to zero. And I can't really fault them for just over-optimizing while they have the traffic and the ads are working and the product is trending. And
make hay while the sun shines.
Yeah. Like, as long as you're aware, and like you're very aware that you're not building a brand, you're just striking on an opportunity. Nothing wrong with that. For Shopify stores that are truly building a brand, and it's, you know, those founders that are passionate about making the product and the background of the product and the history and educating on the product, over-optimized stores, just, it's the death of the brand. It's the death of that journey you're trying to get on of being a 5-10 year brand, the brand that says established in, and it's not 2025. That's what you're trying to get after, and over-optimizing your store, while it may provide some short-term profits, you're just killing the brand. And I'm sure you're very aware of this, but maybe people listening, what I mean by that is just there's so much. It's kind of like when you, I'm sure it's the same in the US, but like when furniture stores, you can tell they're really struggling and there's signs all over, like every second week there's a warehouse sale. Like,
yeah, store
we all know warehouse. Yeah, we all know warehouse sale means you're fucking making no sales right now, and you have no idea how to push product for the new product coming in.
There's a furniture store in my town that I'm pretty sure has been in their final closing days for the last 10 years.
Every time those signs go up, you're like, okay, well, I'm willing to pay less and less and less because you're just killing your brand, and that's what most over-optimized stores look like to me. They look like they're going out of, you know, they have an announcement bar at the top that's got a 24-hour remaining 60% off sale that every day I go, it's the same 24 hours, started again. None of them have ever turned it off. And it's just, you know, maybe not every customer realizes it, but most customers understand it's all bullshit. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, they're not stupid.
I mean, it's just straight up dark patterns. It's like you can't have a permanent sale because it's not a sale. You know, you can't have these urgency timers that just go to zero and reset because they're meaningless. Like, you know, what are you doing?
I think it comes down to the founders just deciding what type of brand they want to be, what type of product they want to be. Because if I just see something going viral on TikTok and I'm like, oh, wait, my buddy has a factory that can make that. I could have that here in 2 weeks. Okay, quick packaging, done. As long as you're aware that that's probably going to be a 12-month lifespan.
If it's fidget spinners.
Yeah, like over-optimize all you want. Just go for it.
Yeah, go wild if it's fidget spinners. Okay, I think that's a great place to wrap this up. Any closing thoughts?
We get a lot of, just on my end, we get a lot of people that come to audit and they think of like, how does exactly what audit does fit into what I do? And honestly, I don't think enough people just book a call with us, because the calls are literally just me walking through your site with you and pointing out a lot of this stuff that maybe you're not seeing. There's no sales pressure. Oftentimes we don't even talk about our products. That's usually done over email if there's a follow-up from them. So I would just say, if some of these things are things that you're stressed that you're not tackling or things that you feel like you're doing wrong, don't hesitate to reach out. You can message me on Twitter. You can go to our site and book a call.
What's the site?
Audit.co, O-D-D-I-T.co.
All right. I'll make sure to include it in the show notes, because I have been on the receiving end of the audit reports from clients. And then, you know, we go through it together and we decide like, okay, this is what's practical and this is what we want to try. And then we implement the stuff. And I've always found them very helpful.
That's great. I appreciate that.
So, all right. Sean Brand, Audit. Thank you so much. This has been great.
Thanks so much, Kurt. I appreciate it, man. Have a good day.
Crowdfunding campaigns are great. You can add social proof and urgency to your product pre-orders while reducing risk of failure. But with traditional crowdfunding platforms, you're paying high fees and giving away control, all while your campaign is lost in a sea of similar offers. It can be frustrating. That's why we built Crowdfunder, the Shopify app that turns your Shopify product pages into your own independent crowdfunding campaigns. We originally created Crowdfunder for our private clients, and it was so successful, we turned it into an app that anyone can use. Today, merchants using Crowdfunder have raised millions collectively. With Crowdfunder, you'll enjoy real-time tracking, full campaign control, and direct customer engagement. And it's part of the Built for Shopify program, so you know it's easy to use. So say goodbye to high fees and hello to successful store-based crowdfunding. Start your free trial and transform your Shopify store into a pre-order powerhouse today. Search Crowdfunder in the Shopify App Store to get started.